Hello, and welcome to Need to Know, your weekly investment podcast brought to you by the experts at Coutts. I'm Sarah Muir, and I'm joined as always by Coutts CIO Alan Higgins. Now, as we've mentioned on recent episodes of Need to Know, we are all very aware of the tragic events in the Middle East right now. But we're going to leave discussion of geopolitics to those that are far more qualified than us. So each week on Need to Know, we look at the three things investors need to know, whether that's for the week ahead, as well as longer term trends. And also we get Alan to read some of the research so that we don't have to. But before we get to the three things, Alan, now I sent you a little bit of homework last week. Have you done your homework?
I believe so. It was because we were talking about the equity risk premium. God, that sounds dull, doesn't it?
But
basically, how expensive or cheap are equities compared to bonds, principally. And I took people back to 87. When the numbers were like this, a 10-year US Treasury bond yield at 10% and a PE ratio of 20.
Nice.
You know, and a reminder, how does that compare today? Probably, you know, 18 or something PE ratio versus 5. Okay, so 5 is half then, obviously, unless my maths degree is failing me.
I think you're right.
Extreme, but, and I said equities did well, and you said something along the lines to prove it.
I did. I think it was, we're talking 87 to 90, aren't we?
Yeah.
So, go on then.
So the show me the numbers. Crash was a big one, a minus 35% event. So if I said to you, you start investing in 1987 and three years later, do you think you would have done well, average or poorly in equities, including the 35% crash?
Knowing you, I'm going to say I would have done well.
Yeah. You know me too well now. Incredibly, that 87 to 82, US equities were up 61%, 17% including a 37% crash. Now, to be fair, it was a period of strong earnings growth, which, you know, I've clumsily called the truth in equity investing. It was it was a period of very strong earnings growth. Okay. But it just goes to show where you've got to be careful in comparing a nominal asset, bonds, with a growth asset like equity. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely a valid comparison. Yeah. But I think almost the human brain finds it harder, including mine, by the way, harder to come to terms with the growth element of equities. And to a certain extent, actually, by the way, had an interesting meeting with a lot of property execs in the office the other day, and we were talking about, you know, they agreed it's really underestimated. What do I mean by property as a growth asset? Well, of course, if you live in your own property and or if you rent one out, people will know it's called in the States, they call it the imputed rent, the rent you could have if you rent out your house, or if you're lucky enough to be a property investor, the actual rent you're receiving, it goes up. Rent goes up.
Because it does. It never goes down.
Yeah, never's a strong word.
Very rarely. That's true. Sorry. So very rarely goes
asset.
Down.
It's a growth asset.
Yeah.
So, 87 to 89, even though the equity risk premium got stretched to ridiculous levels and we had a 35% crash, great time to be invested in equities.
Okay. All right then. And on the subject of talking about bonds, of course, before we get on to the sort of weakness in markets, which I've already preempted what your first one is, but we're getting some slightly less bearish sort of thoughts on bonds at the moment, aren't we, from some of the sort of key movers in the market?
Key movers, should we call them celebrities? Bill Gross and Bill Ackman.
The bond king, Bill Gross, isn't he?
He is the bond king, and to be fair, phenomenal career managing bond money, so to be respected. Bill Ackman, to be fair, a phenomenal hedge fund manager. His normal world is equities, but, you know, look, he's a hedge fund manager, so he can go anywhere. To be fair, they haven't gone long yet. So they were short the market.
Right.
We talked a lot about shorting the market. They were short the market, and they've covered their short. And that makes sense. I'm sure if I was clever as them to be short the market outright personally, I probably would cover as well, because 5%, that does seem like a pretty handy return. It's not like me when I was a young 21-year-old in 1987 seeing 10% and thinking, oh, this is fairly normal. 10% is great. no, but 5 is a lot higher than we've seen for a long, long time.
Yeah. And I guess from what I saw from Bill Ackman, his rationale was basically there's too much risk in the world to to continue to be bearish bonds.
Fair. I mean, I think that's fair. You know, you know, geopolitically, economically, I think that's very fair. No strong reason to be short. I accept that.
Okay. All right then. Well, the three things then we need to know this week. Now, I say a preemptive because we're going to talk about weakness in markets. But what are the other two things?
So a little bit current, but you know, weakness in markets. So those of you who pick up the podcast early, it's going to be in the middle of this 8% correction. So let's talk about this weakness in market, what we think about. The second part I want to talk about, again, we have alluded to it, but a bit more depth on the nature of equity returns. You know, about surges, maybe as we're getting closer to the year end, talk about annual returns and the nature of annual returns. And I might bring in that old fraudster Bernie Madoff into that.
Yes. Yeah, I think that was your other bit of homework actually from last week.
Oh, was it? Was I promise? Was it homework?
I think it was.
I'm glad.
I think it was. Yeah. So that's
you
good.
Write things down because honestly, I find it hard to remember.
You got nothing to think about, Alan. All right. And what's the third one?
Third one. I think I've changed my mind. You know, and
really?
Yes,
no, you
I've changed my mind. So the great index versus passive. And it's fair to say I'm fairly well known as a proponent for index investing in foods, right?
You're a big advocate of index investing, Alan. I mean, you're a big advocate of equities, but equities via an index fund, via a tracker fund.
So I changed my mind. Let's save it till the end. Let's not give all the secrets away. Okay. But let's go.
No. There's a little cliffhanger for you. Okay. Yeah. All right, then. Well, let's kick off with weakness in markets. And as you said, we're in the middle of currently, at the time of recording, about a sort of 8% correction in US markets, aren't we? I guess the question would be, is that cause for concern? What's causing that?
So to your last question, what's causing that? This is the beauty of our business. I'm going to say it again. We only have theories. We can prove nothing, Sarah. We can prove absolutely nothing. But here comes a theory. It's the Bill Ackman,
here's
Bill
a theory.
Gross. Yeah, Bill Ackman, Bill Gross. It's bond yields. So look, we absolutely concede this rise in bond yields and interest rates in general has put pressure on equities. However, we say the risk premium is not so stretched like 1987, one, and two, bond yields aren't really high enough to completely undermine equities. But yeah, it's having an impact. And so our theory would be higher bond yields having an impact here.
Okay. So it's less about the geopolitics then. It's more about what's happening in markets, the technical things that's happening in markets. Yeah. Is that fair to say?
Look, we would think so because post the tragic events that we did see, the S&P 500, for example, rise a couple of percent. Therefore, geopolitics doesn't, as at the time of writing, doesn't, the tragic events, as you say, we've seen in the Middle East, the geopolitics doesn't seem to be the main factor. It is really about pessimism and higher rates and a lot of things we've said before. And related to that, you mentioned we read the research. So I've got Merrill Lynch research, not Savita this time. Those of you who listened before, we talked about Savita.
Okay. Yeah. As a rare she's bull. Quite bullish, isn't she?
She's a rare bull. This is Michael Hartnett, who does kind of the global research. And he's one of the biggest bears. But he looks at things very fairly, which makes him so successful. He's got actually quite an interesting kind of contrarian indicator. It's called the bull bear indicator. And he's calling it gives it a contrarian buy right now. So he's calling for a buy. So if I put it in how we talk about it, I think he's basically saying this is just one of your classic 10% corrections.
And which happen pretty much every year, don't they?
They do. And just looking at his from these levels, I'm just looking at his research now. There looks like about 20 of them of these bull signals. And it looks like about 15 out of 20 work, some spectacularly. And the 3-month median return, as opposed to average, the median return is about 8%. Mm. So you normally do see a big bounce, but you know what was it based on? It's mainly based on outflows. So the way he looks at it is that when you see outflows from equities, sector by sector, he takes that as a bullish sign. He sees it as investors selling too late, and it's a trading rule. The other symbol in there is in their Bank of America or Merrill Lynch survey. Investors like ourselves have too much in cash. That's another component. So he's got various components in there, and other firms do this kind of indicator. Citi do it pretty well, but I just think it's very interesting. It's come out as a tactical buy, and that looks right for me. This looks like a classic 10%. Which we see nearly every year, not every year, but nearly every year.
Yeah. And we've already had one this year, haven't we? Well, not quite, wasn't quite 10%, was it? Was another 8% one earlier in the year, didn't we?
Yeah, we had another kind of virtual 8% March this year. Again, a very pessimistic scenario. Interestingly, that time it was all about recession coming. If you remember earlier this year, it was all about, God, inverted curve, recession coming. Now it's more about how we're going to deal with inflation. Now it's all about, oh my God, the economy's still strong. How high will interest rates go? So it goes to show two different 8% corrections this year.
Yeah. And do you think this has got, I mean, do you think, would Michael Burry have been looking at this? I mean, we're back to our friend Michael Burry again in his big short. But would this have been what he was thinking about possibly with that short that he had in place?
So
a couple of months ago?
$1.6 billion short position. Nominal, at least expressed in futures, etc. Is this enough for him? I don't think it's enough for him. Some of his positions may have got its way, but this is the tricky thing when you do this in options. When you do this in options in particular, you pay up premium and it really eats into return. Okay. So you kind of need the market to fall biggish. I think he's probably hoping for something more like minus 20. He may get it. Minus 20% obviously do happen. Again, they're rare. My sense, you know, my money would be on Bank of America, contrarian buy signal. It's got a fairly good track record. It's not perfect. Nothing is, of course, in finance. Mm. But I think, and for what it's worth, because, you know, when the Coutts tactical team do agree with what we say, I think it is worth, you know, we try to be more general on that, but for what it's worth, the Coutts tactical team at the time of writing do completely agree with it and buy into this as more of an option. Okay.
So we're seeing this correction then. To sort of summarise, we're so far at the moment, we're about sort of 8% correction in US markets. That, from what Michael Hartnett's sort of observing, that's a sort of a bull signal, and it's possibly an opportunity to sort of go back into markets. Is that fair? Is that a fair summary?
Simple as that, yeah. I agree, yeah. Simple as that, yeah.
Okay. All right, then. Well, let's move on to our next one, then, which is staying on the subject, obviously, of equities, but equity, the nature of equity returns and this kind of annualized returns and what's normal and perhaps the difference between average and actual, because there's a bit of a difference there, isn't there? It could be a bit misleading.
There is, and I think it's really important for clients to come to terms with, because once you come to terms with it and expect it, so big picture, and this is the US, but it's actually similar for the UK. I know people think the UK has been a disastrous market. Certainly the FTSE 100 has been poor for the last 10 to 15 years, maybe even longer, but actually in the long run, it has equaled the S&P 500. And I think I've mentioned the FTSE 250 before, Sarah, the next 250, that has rivaled the S&P 500. So anyway, the numbers are like this, and I'm going to round them just to make it kind of easier to comprehend. Since 1926, we're human, we think in calendar years. What happens? Okay, I'll do it in, you know, basically 3 out of 10 years, you should have a negative return. Historically, not you should, you have had. You've had a negative
you
return.
You will get, or you have had,
okay, just like last year. So, you know. Yes. On average, 3 out of 10 years. Okay. However, 6 out of 10 years, the market is up big. Big means more than 10%. More than 10%. Okay. More than 10%.
Is it really that often? That seems incredible.
Yeah, I know. Because we forget about it. We forget about the good years. There was a famous survey done about 2009 when the market was up about 20%, but that was the recovery from the financial crisis. Have I mentioned this before? I can't remember if I have. If I haven't,
I think you may have done.
Yeah, okay. Nevertheless, we haven't come to the podcast. Anyway, the key point is people, your average person in the street in the United States, who are much more sophisticated about investing, I'm afraid to say, than people in the UK in general, they thought it was a terrible year for the stock market because they had memories of the financial crisis. Yes. But actually, the year was a 20% year. So yes, 6 out of 10 are really good years. And only 1 out of 10 is a 0 to 10% year when we're up, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9%. We're up about 10% year to date. So we're kind of on the threshold of that.
Yeah.
So it's, and nevertheless, the market annualizes at 9, but almost never makes 9.
Yeah. But
The fact that people don't like that. Well, firstly, investors generally hate it. They hate that profile. Mm. If you talk to an average investor and say, like, yeah, three years out of 10, you're going to be down. What? Okay, but six out of 10, you're going to be up bigger. Okay, fine. But 3 out of 10, I'm going to be down. And only 1 year out of 10, you're going to make a normal type return. That's horrible. I say, but that's life. In contrast, fraudster Bernie Madoff took advantage of that. There's been a fair few Netflix shows about it, but I do remember, I mean, it's a real tragedy because it destroyed some very, you know, important charities. But his was, I've got the returns right in front of me here. I've got his monthly returns from December. This is a different period, December 91 to December 07. Two of them add off. So the S&P 500 made 9% over that period. So not quite 9.5, 9.
Yeah.
But, you know, with a lot of volatility, including the massive crash of 2000, 2002, but 9% compound. Bernie Madoff also made 9%. But Sarah, I think we're sharing the graph. If I asked you to describe the Bernie Madoff performance chart, how would you describe it?
I would say it was a sort of straight line going at sort of 45 degrees, just continuous.
So virtually,
no ups and downs.
Exactly. Virtually every month was 0.8, 0.9. And it's, for example, just to throw out some years, 2002 was one of these down years, minus 22%. Madoff, plus 9. I'm rounding.
Okay.
And 2003, just to give the other side of it, plus 29%. Madoff, plus 8. And that's why Madoff raised so much money, because he didn't look like he was getting any more than the S&P 500. But people were greedy for the lack of volatility. There's a different type of greed.
Yeah, I was going to say, because they weren't greedy for returns, because you weren't getting more in theory from Bernie Madoff's fund than you would get if you invested in the S&P. But did no one stop? Well, I suppose they did right at the end and go, hang on, how can the S&P be down 20% yet this fund is down, you know, hardly at all? It wasn't until right at the end, was it, then people started to look at it and go, hang on a minute, this doesn't make sense. But what's he doing?
Well, there was a couple of
people that's allowing him to beat the market.
There's a couple of people who spotted it, including, do you remember our old friend Ed Thorpe, who made that great money? The guy, the blackjack card counter and great.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So he spotted it. And there was someone called, Harry Markopoulos, who spotted it and even wrote letters to the SEC very early. And they ignored him. So a couple of people did. I have to say, I didn't. And the story was, obviously, he's not doing conventional equity investing. The story was he was doing something very, very interesting in options. You know, I will, maybe at a different stage, I'll come back to the exact detail because it is complex. It's actually not that complex, but nevertheless, as soon as you go into options, we're going to talk, it's going to sound complex. And the kind of idea was that because he was also a market maker, as well as a hedge fund manager, he had amazing flow and he could make money from amazing flow. That was the belief. And to be fair, it wasn't just charities and individuals. Some of the most prestigious managers of hedge funds in the world, especially the ones based in Switzerland, got completely caught out with some of the smartest due diligence people you could find. So there you go, no shame. But the point being, going back to my starting point, Madoff is not real, obviously, but it is psychologically what people want. But come to terms with the nature of equity investing. What Warren Buffett, has a phrase in the long run, it's all about kind of weighing it, and the truth comes out. The truth of owning a good company, your multiple good companies, or the index will come out. In the short run, just accept the volatility. That's the nature of that's unfortunately the penalty for being liquid. Private equity doesn't have
the price of entry.
It's the price of entry,
isn't it?
It's the price of entry. Yeah, you know it's real, I suppose. I have actually said that before.
And
when they're down 70%, I say, well, at least you know it's real when Madoff has come up.
So what perhaps investors need to get away from is fixating on the sort of annualized return and accept that that's an average, and they're never going to, or very, well, as you said, 1 year out of 10, if their annualized return is 9%, there's only going to be 1 year out of 10 when they're probably going to get something like, they might get 9%. Three years out of 10, they'll be negative. Yeah. But actually, what I find incredible is that 6 years out of 10, more than half of the time, they will finish more than 10% up.
Yeah. I mean, some of those numbers are only 10, 11, 12, to be fair.
We're not talking 30% or something.
A lot of them are big, just looking here. I mean, the late 1990s was ridiculous. Okay, that was a bubble. 2006 up 16%. I mean, sorry, I've only got the Madoff returns for me, but yeah, you do get big years.
Okay, right then. So that's it. It's understanding then the nature of equity returns, being comfortable with that sort of those up years, the down years, as well as the up years. You've got to take the rough with the smooth when you invest in equities, and just understanding that. Well, as I say, most of the time you're going to do fine, but there are going to be those years when you are in negative territory. Okay, so that's the nature of equity returns. Last bit then was about you're changing your mind about index investing. Are you really changing your mind about index investing?
Yeah, I am. Look, so super long term, no. But it's become so extreme. I can see multiple years now where the major indices can outperform. And to put that in context, the index has been a superstar. And when we started the Coutts Multi-Asset Fund in 2012, we absolutely embraced index investing. That's kind of the way we did it. We did invest in active funds as well. We absolutely embraced index investing as part of our strategy. But now, look, why? Well, actually, let's look at the data. Over 5 years, for example, 75% of active managers underperform in the United States. If you go over 10 years, it's closer to 90. Almost no one does. This year is a terrible year for active.
Yeah. Is that because of the Magnificent Seven? I mean, well, obviously that wasn't the case perhaps 5 years ago, but this year it's about the Magnificent Seven, isn't it?
This year it is. But other years, one, it's a difficult job, okay? It's a difficult job. And it does seem that a small number of stocks. And we have talked about this. You remember that guy from that professor from Arizona we went into? Who's done research about only a small number of stocks drive the market.
Yes.
My brain's faded. Professor Hendrik Benis Mind or something like that has done some amazing research.
Okay.
Google it, you'll find it. Anyway, so there's that. So it's been tough, but this is why I think I'm changing my mind. One, the top seven stocks in the US now make up 30% of the benchmark, way more than 2,000. Okay, so that's 500 stocks, but the top seven are at 30. Okay, so the UK, we've got only 100 stocks on our FTSE 100. Well, the top seven are at 40%. That's also on the high side. But look at that.
Yeah.
That's, 7 make 30. There's 493 left over, obviously, you know, whereas in the FTSE 100, it's kind of 96, and I'm getting maths right, 93 versus 7. It's a different order. So this concentration, the expensiveness of these stocks, the Magnificent Seven and Berkshire Hathaway, that's in there as well, and I think NVIDIA is just on the outside. You can call it the top eight, if you like. Very, very expensive. And then my contrarian indicator in Insix took over. There's two articles that have come out. One amazing one in the Wall Street Journal. I don't know how they've done it, but the so-called dumb money is actually outperformed.
That was what I was going to say. I read a little bit about that. Yes, so you were talking about how difficult it is for active managers, but apparently it's not so difficult for retail investors.
Yeah, and by dumb money, I don't mean the meme stock that we talked about before. We're talking about just your average retail investor in the United States. This firm, I think it's called Vandas Research, have somehow got some performance numbers. I'm going to have a closer look to verify. But it has a ring of truth in it. Why? Well, individual investors, what do they buy? Apple, Amazon, Tesla.
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe Johnson & Johnson, maybe JP Morgan. They buy the big stocks. They've all performed tremendously. And the work shows, amazingly, that the average US investor, individual investor, is up 15% compound, which is incredible. Whereas, in contrast, the professional investor is suffering. And then we saw a great article in Bloomberg Research I shared with you.
Yes, about, you did, yeah.
You know, how Aberdeen, Invesco, Jupiter, even the mighty Schroders in this country, and in the States, Invesco is suffering so badly from this. And what really piqued my contrarian indicators, contrarian indicators inside me, was Aberdeen almost saying we no longer compete in mainstream global equity and mainstream US equity. We've almost given up.
Everything is index investing.
Yeah, it's almost given up on trying to compete in that space. And I thought, it's gone. The combination of the Magnificent Seven dominance, all the flows going into index, almost zero flows into active. And I don't know for how long. And hey, look, I'm an investor, so I've been wrong many times before. When I put all this together, you know, I really do think it's time for active now. And as for how we manage money at Coutts, you know, talk to your banker about that. And that's, you know, a different matter. This is for the podcast. And this is my, these days I advise, as you know, Sarah, I advise and mentor the investment team. Yeah. And this is the advice and mentoring I'm going to be giving them. I'm going to tell them, in my view, it's time for active.
So we've reached peak passive investing and it's time now to look at active again. No, maybe we're not going to throw the baby out of the bathwater. We're still going to keep passive. And we're not saying passive is going to disappear, but we're just saying that maybe investors should start thinking about active investing again.
Yeah, a bold call to say it's peak, I don't know. And for how many years, I don't know. If you're asking me, Alan, are you ever going to buy an index fund again in your life? Is that it for you, that you're done with this? No, I'm sure I'll come back. And I should say, just to get the other side of the story, we like to give a bit of a book recommendation, don't we?
Yeah, we do.
So I have mentioned it before, but it was in the very early days of the podcast, a book called Trillions by Robert Wigglesworth, an FT journalist, a brilliant book about how passive investing started and how it really boomed after the financial crisis and has been absolutely dominant. And, you know, lots of great stories about the likes of Vanguard, the BlackRock story, how it all started with Wells Fargo. So a really interesting read. I've read that cover to cover, but let's take this date. What's the date? 24th of October. Higgins says go active, and we'll mark me to market, put it in your notes, because you know I will forget. You know, like any convenience.
Oh, I'll remember. Don't worry, I'll remember. It's interesting, as you say, because we were talking before, it's index investing has been around for what? We're talking about 10 years, something like that? 10, 12 years?
No, 10 years or longer than that. It's been around since the 1970s, but it just didn't take off.
Okay.
People didn't believe it.
Okay.
You know, if you're trying to remember, I think Wells Fargo was one of the firms that really started it, and then Vanguard.
Right, okay.
came out of split out of Wellington Asset Management. Okay, by the end of 1977, there was about 2.9 billion of money in index strategies. Only 2.9 billion in 1977. So it was around, but one, it was somewhat expensive. I guess didn't have the computer technology to make it super easy like now. And two, people just didn't believe in it. People believed in active management. Now it's the other way around. Virtually no one believes in active management, including the active managers. Yeah. So let's see, you know, it's great making these bold predictions because, you know, if I'm wrong, only you will remember. Well, actually, some of our clients are keen to remind me of things.
You know, they will definitely remember. They'll pick you up. Yeah, next client dinner, they'll be picking that up with you. Okay, so we're saying then essentially, yeah, there's, you know, the dominance of passive investing has sort of grown over the last 10 years, but maybe we might be reaching sort of peak sort of index investing. Could we be starting to see a resurgence in active investing again, or sort of the more interest in active managers again? We'll have to wait and see, but that's certainly something that Alan is calling. We'll keep an eye on that one. If we see anything more that can prove him right or wrong, we'll make sure we bring that to you. All right. Thank you very much, Alan. A reminder that the views expressed in this podcast are not intended to constitute investment advice, are accurate at the time of recording, and are subject to change. Thank you very much, Alan, for joining me today. Don't forget to check out the podcast page on Coutts.com. And of course, hopefully you're already a subscriber to the podcast via wherever you get your podcast from. We've got a couple of episodes coming up, which should be going up sort of online fairly soon. We've got one on investor psychology. And next week, we're going to be talking to Howard Sparks, who's our US equities expert, all about US earnings season. Lots to talk about there. How are the banks doing? What are the tech firms doing? What we've heard so far, you know, and also more importantly, what's the forward guidance for next year? So we've got that to look forward to. Until the next Need to Know, bye for now.